Kill them. Kill them both. We're missing the Antiques Roadshow.
We're interrupting this program to bring you the most exciting piece of news that's happened since the war.
Anything can happen in the next hour.
Who else has electricity streaming from his eyeballs and from his fingers?
Can you dig it? Can you dig it? Can you dig it?
You said I was an enemy of society? All right, I'll show you what I think of your society.
You're talking about cause and effect in the outside world. We're not living in the outside world.
You know, it's a pity you weren't born a girl.
Yes, I've always envied you that.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast.
Paleo Cinema Podcast looks at movies between 1895 and 1990. We cover all mainstream and genre films, books, TV, and whatever else Terry gets obsessed about. The email address is cultguru@gmail.com. That's cultguru@gmail.com. The new voicemail number is 206-350-5440, or you can leave messages on Skype at Paleo Cinema, all lowercase and no dash. This podcast may include swearing and adult content, so if you hear anything you don't understand, just fucking Google it.
Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 59. My name is Terry Frost. And yes, I am back from the World Science Fiction Convention. Had a hell of a time, really. Enjoyed myself, caught up with old friends, made some new friends. Spent 5 days wandering an enormous entertainment centre, which myself and other people have said is like a TARDIS. From the outside, it looks very small, but from the inside, it is fucking enormous. And yeah, it was good. There were all sorts of big name people there from the science fiction world. Kim Stanley Robinson, George R. R. Martin, Cory Doctorow, Charlie Stross, Rob Shearman, any number of people there. So basically for 5 days I was at the center of the science fiction universe with a couple of thousand other people. Caught up with a lot of people. Had a lot of tapas because the closest place to eat was a tapas bar attached to the Hilton Hotel next door. Saw the Hugo Awards being given out and agreed with every single category. And congratulations to Starship Sofa for winning Best Fanzine Award for 2009. And I was just blitzed. One of the things that actually happened there, Twitter was very big at the Worldcon. People, the whole convention had a kind of subtext of Twitter streams and Facebook posts and things like that, kind of real-time commenting on what was going on. So I was on 5 panels, as it turned out, during the convention, 3 or 4 of which worked very, very well, and 2 that didn't. But one of the panels I was on was about new media, because podcasting, of course, being new media. And I was on the panel with Alison Croghan, a very nice woman from Melbourne who is a poet, a writer, and a blogger as well. And there was also somebody on the panel from the US who reviews movies for a newspaper in New Orleans. And we kind of talked around new media compared to old media, how new media and the rise of the amateur critic and commentator, being myself in this case, changes the dynamic of the interaction between an audience and people who are reviewing things. So we had a lot of good fun with that. I think it went very, very well because 2 people came up to me afterwards. One person wants me to write about podcasting, and I've got to contact her back about that as soon as I can. And the other was a guy who does podcasts in Sydney about whom I knew nothing. He's only 800 kilometers away. I knew nothing about what he's done. His name is Erk, E-R-K. And if you type ERK as one word and then pod as another in iTunes or whichever feed aggregator that you've got, you'll find ERK Pod. He does a very different kind of podcast to what I do. He does some music stuff. He does what's happening with him stuff. But he's also a science fiction fan of sorts. And we caught up. And ERK actually interviewed me for ERK Pod, which I was stunned by. This is the only interview I've had in a very, very, very long time that didn't involve me getting a job. And I'm just going to, before everything else starts now, play the interview that Erk did with me at AussieCon 4, with me talking about podcasting and how I do podcasts and things like that. It's a bit self-indulgent, so please bear with me, or skip over about 10 minutes and get into the talk about movies. We'll be talking about movies soon, but I'll just play this one, and I'll be back after that is done.
It's later on Sunday afternoon at AussieCon, and let me say, this couch is absolutely wonderful. It's been a highly contested spot and just the thing you need towards the end of a day. And with me, we have a fellow Aussie podcaster. Hello, Terry.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, mate. How are you?
It's the fourth day of the convention, so it's a little bit tiring, but I've been pacing myself, and we'll get there, yeah.
So why don't you tell us a little bit about your podcast?
It's called Paleo Cinema Podcast with a dash, because I couldn't get Paleo Cinema on Blogspot without the dash. And what I do is, when I was looking at doing a podcast, I knew I wanted to do a movie podcast. So what I ended up doing was researching, and everybody's doing recent films. There's a glut of, at the time, and this was 3 years ago, there was a glut of people doing podcasts about recent films, and being a movie buff all along the spectrum of film, I thought, if I stick to an earlier time and do older ones, I can help people discover different films.
Yep.
And from there, I decided I was going to have a cut-off point at that stage of 1977, because I believe that's when George Lucas ruined science fiction film. And it went from there.
So do you restrict yourself to sci-fi?
No, not at all. I mean, I've done everything. I came from a science fiction fan. I've been a science fiction fan since 1979 and a part of active science fiction fandom since then. I came into podcasting as another way of doing a fanzine almost. And I cover all sorts of things. I cover everything from French films from the 1950s. I've done film noir. I've done horror. I've done, of course, science fiction. I've even done French musicals in the 1960s. Whichever kind of movie grabs me, anything that's unusual I think the audience might like, I go with it.
And so tell people at home how we found each other. It was an interesting way, a new media sort of way.
Yeah, on Twitter. We were tweeting at each other on the hashtag stream for the convention, and it kind of rose from there.
I was in the, it's sort of a new media, like, in relation to your online persona with people like Merle Lafferty and Cory Doctorow at the time. Where were you? You were somewhere else pimping your next session.
Yeah, I wanted to get a few people in because I just had a couple of panels that pretty much didn't have an audience for some reason. And I thought I'd pimp it out on the Twitter stream and met you.
Which was quite awesome because I wasn't even going to go to your session. And then when I found out that it had a podcasting element, because a lot of these sessions haven't, I thought that was really good.
Yeah, absolutely. And that one that failed, though, that's the interesting one, because it was on at 10 o'clock in the morning, two people in the audience. One of the other panelists brought a bottle of bourbon with her. And we ended up, everybody had a glass of bourbon, and we just watched YouTube videos on the big screen for the whole hour.
So how did you get into podcasting in the first place? How did you discover it?
Well, I've always kind of been tapped into new media, and I read Boing Boing. I did all those sort of things. I know a lot of people who are tech geeks in a sense. So when podcasting came along, I became aware of it. When I got an iPod, of course, iTunes came along with that, and podcasts became an option. I knew that people were starting to do them beside the big professional things like the BBC. And I've found that this was something that I like doing.
One of the interesting things you were telling me was where your audience are from.
Yeah, predominantly my audience isn't in Australia. Overwhelmingly, because it's a movie podcast in some ways, it's in North America, it's in the UK, it's in Western Europe, and increasingly in Eastern Asia. So I've kind of gone at it differently. It's not geographically based for me. It's very much a global thing, and my podcast hosting place allows me to see where people are downloading it on a map, and that's how I tapped into my audience.
And you've also got an interesting production schedule.
Yeah, every 3 weeks. I take a week off. I do research the next weekend for the movies, book and web research. I try to make sure I go to multiple sources. And then the weekend after that, on the Sunday, I lock Sally, my wife, in the other end of the house, and I podcast up in the back room.
And so what's your setup?
Basically, I've tried a few things. I've tried Blue Snowball microphones. I tried a podcast factory.
But now what I tend to do, and simplest of all, I've got a Microsoft live chat headset mic. And because I do a solo podcast, the ugliest and hardest of them all, it works for me.
Which is absolutely awesome. Now, what other Australian podcasts do you listen to? Do you listen to any?
I listen to Galactic Suburbia, the Australian science fiction one that three females are involved in writing and editing science fiction. They Skype together from Perth, Hobart and Melbourne. And I knew them beforehand, so I do that. Other Australian ones, let me think. Box Cutters, of course. I listen to Box Cutters, who are at the convention. And pretty much haven't really gone into it that much. I tend to listen to more to movie podcasts and maybe some tech geek kind of podcast, but it's a little hard to find a common place where we can find a listing of podcasts.
And that's where things have been difficult, and it's always great to find other Australian podcasters, not necessarily in the same sort of style that I'm doing it or that you're doing it, but we're all Australian. We've all got the same sort of barriers, if you like.
Yeah.
And so it's important, I think.
I mean, I know that because a number of podcasters I know in the States can meet up every now and then. But we've got that tyranny of distance with people overseas where I send them voicemails, they send me voicemails, that kind of thing. But meetups are going to be impossibly expensive for any party involved. So it's nice to get together with podcasters. Yeah.
And that's the thing about it. I've been podcasting since early 2007.
Mm.
And the last PodCamp that was held was around about that same time in Perth, and I haven't heard of one since. If anyone knows of one, let us know.
Yeah, any information you give about podcasting, I'm happy to disseminate it. I'm happy to be a part of it. And but it is hard to source because in Australia, I think one of the problems is podcasting isn't on the radar as much as it is in some other countries.
So tell us about what this convention has meant to you. What are some of the things that you've got out of it?
For me, because I've been to any number of conventions, I've been to three AussieCons now, and I've been to 20 or more conventions, including some overseas. It's meeting up with old friends, meeting new friends, catching up with people. The social aspect of it's very important, and I also like the opportunity that they give me to sit on a panel, talk about things I'm interested in with people I may not know but who have similar interests. And I never find being on a panel or being in an audience of a panel less than an educational experience, except when there's only two people in the audience and all we do is drink bourbon.
Yes.
Yep.
Unless, of course, it was a drinking panel, and then that would be ideal.
I have seen drinking panels, and they cannot end well.
No.
No.
So it's been an absolutely awesome experience over this weekend. Is there one sort of highlight?
I did like the guest of honour speech with Kim Stanley Robinson. I think Kim being, in essence, a utopian writer, and it's interesting to... I've been to conventions where the guests of honour assume that war and conflict and non-cooperation among people is the default setting for the human race. And I don't believe that for a second. And I hadn't met Kim before. He did come as guest of honour in a convention in 1995 in Tasmania, where I met him there. It's very much a small convention, so social aspects were good. And I love the fact that his career has only been enhanced since then. And I think that he's an important voice in science fiction because of that fact that he's got the guts to be optimistic.
And so has the online element, things like Twitter, has that helped you enjoy the conference?
Yeah. I tweeted during his guest of honour speech. I tweeted little bits of what he was doing. I was monitoring the Twitter stream as well, doing that. And it's a real-time commentary track to what's happening. I mean, occasionally it's filled with people retweeting other people's stuff, but there's little essences and little observations that enhance the experience. I mean, I've got to be a little careful because I can tend to focus on the Twitter stream more than the wonderfulness of the talk in front of me.
Yeah.
But I think I'm multitasking that okay. And when I feel myself getting too involved in the Twitter stream rather than what's in front of me, I'll step away from it for a few moments and just enjoy what the guest is saying. So I love that fact that there's underlying metadata under the whole convention.
And finally, of course, there's one question that I've got to ask you. As a movie podcaster, what's your favourite movie?
You've got to ask me that about twice a day because it changes. I'm very fond of an old movie about Hollywood called The Bad and the Beautiful from 1952. I keep going back to The Crimson Pirate with Burt Lancaster. I like old films as well. Recent films I like, I did see a really gory Australian horror film called Dying Breed. It's all about Tasmanian cannibals and things. I kind of liked that from a horror geek point of view. It's one of those questions like, what kind of food do you want?
Yeah. And you made a really awesome comment yesterday in the panel in relation to Avatar.
Yeah, it's Dances with Smurfs. I mean, I thought it was very pretty. I mean, if I had to do a one-word review of Avatar, I would say pretty. But I don't know if it's... It's not something I haven't seen done without the wonderful CGI elsewhere. You've seen that in Westerns. You've seen that in another format before. And that's part... The story part of it's disappointing.
Awesome. So why don't you tell us, Terry, how do we find you on the interweb and also Twitter?
Okay, you find me on Twitter. You can either do it as Paleo Cinema, PaleoCinema, one word, lowercase, or as Terry Frost, one word, lowercase. And as far as my website's concerned, it's paleo, paleo-cinema.blogspot.com. I usually add YouTube video clips of the movies I'm doing. And please do, and let me know if you do enjoy it.
Awesome. Thanks, Terry, and enjoy the rest of the con.
Thanks a lot, Erk. You too.
No worries.
So there you go. Erk's a very nice guy. I recommend you give his podcast a go. See whether it's your kind of thing. He does play a lot of new music that becomes available too. So he's doing good work in that regard. And the interesting thing about Erk too is he also has his mum podcasting with him. So his mother Judy podcasts as well. So it's interesting to get the range of opinions and viewpoints that come through on Erk's podcast. But I'm going to move aside from that now and talk about my podcast and movies. The movies I'm going to do this time, there are three of them, and they're all interesting. One's very obscure, and the other two are slightly obscure, but not too unknown. I'll do the totally obscure one first. I'll tell you what that is. It's a movie called Nothing Lasts Forever from 1984. It's directed by a guy called Tom Schiller, who did a lot of writing for Saturday Night Live. In fact, Lorne Michaels was one of the producers. Stars Zach Galligan, who was in Gremlins, Lauren Tom, Sam Jaffe, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Eddie Fisher, Imogen Coker. Music was a very early score by Howard Shaw. So I won't tell you more about that until I review the movie. The next one is actually a recommendation from Rupert, which is 99 and 44/100th percent Dead, a movie by John Frankenheimer from 1974, starring Richard Harris, Bradford Dillman, and Chuck Connors, which is a weird and wonderful little ride. And the third film, he said, trying to remember because it's been a very hectic week, is a 1962 British horror film called Night of the Eagle, starring Peter Wingard. And I'll just take a little break now, and then I'll get into talking about the first of the movies. I think I'll do them in reverse chronological order, and I will talk about Nothing Lasts Forever first. So I'll take a little bit of a break, give you a bit of music, and then get stuck into it.
That girl over there, I really gotta talk to that chick, cause that is one cool sugar candy girl. Chick, she's a sticky chick, she's a sticky chick. Hello, darling, uh-huh, hello, good looking. 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 Well, in the USA, I was at ball hooking. A little young girl I was seeking. I see a young girl, she started smiling. I walked over, we started talking. I said, hi, baby. She said, how are you keeping? I said, I'm cool, I'm just doing my own thing. She said, hey, man, I hear you are the end thing. Your tip for Ivy from that Saxon sound system. I said, babe, this is my first time in foreign. She said, how about we just make it interesting? I said, there's one thing I wanna do, my darling. We can go home and have a quiet evening. And have a meal, you know, that's very finger licking. And strictly champagne, that's what we'll be drinking. Well, in the next verse, I'll carry on explaining. But right now, I'm one boy and girl to sing. Hello, darling, uh-huh,
hello good looking, hello darling, hello good looking, hello darling, hello good looking, hello darling, hello good looking. Hello, good looking. Hello, darling. Hello, good looking. Hello, darling. Hello, good looking. Hello, darling. Hello, good looking. Now this girl I met, her name was Captain. She had her own place in downtown Brooklyn. She would take a cab, or do you fancy walking? She said, just pull my car's around the next turning. Well, when she said that, I started smiling. Coming home and find a girl with a few shilling. Jumped in the car and then we started driving. Before I knew it, outside her place we were parking. Inside her flat, it was devastating. To be quite honest, it was truly amazing. I put my feet up and started relaxing. After a while, you know, I started thinking, what does this girl do for a living? She said, tipper man, I don't do nothing. I was left $1 million by my uncle Marvin. So I jumped up at the chair, blew her a kiss and said again, hello darling, hello good looking, 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 hello darling, hello good looking.
Okay, that was Tip Iry with Hello Darling, a track that I first heard when I was living in Sydney over 20 years ago. I heard it on Radio Redfern in 1988, which was the local Indigenous radio station, and they played some cool music that nobody else was playing, and that's how I picked up on that track. So, on to the films.
Confusion grips the nation as both coasts suffer catastrophe, chaos, and crisis. On the West Coast, devastation rocks Sunland as citizens try to recover from aftershocks caused by the massive trembler which totally destroyed Los Angeles and vicinity. As heartbroken evacuees make their exodus to a more promised land, this pair of sun-kissed beauties enjoy their own inspection tour of the rubble. Meanwhile, Manhattan is suffering under its 100-day-long crippling general strike, which has affected transportation, shelter, housing, utilities, and gasoline. The city is now under control of the Port Authority.
This is the Port Authority. We are in control of the city. Your cooperation is appreciated.
New entry and residence requirements are in full legal effect for all Gotham-bound visitors. Temporary checkpoints have been set up to accommodate the tremendous influx of unauthorized guests. Well, playtime for fabled Gotham is coming to an end.
Purpose of transit to Manhattan.
I'll just read you the blurb about Nothing Lasts Forever from Wikipedia. Nothing Lasts Forever is a 1984 movie starring a number of high-profile Hollywood actors. It was directed by Tom Schiller, who had previously worked on Saturday Night Live. Although widely regarded as a classic and highly sought after, the movie was given only a very limited theatrical release, and as of 2010 has not been released on home video. The movie stars Zach Galligan and Lauren Tom in the lead roles, with supporting cast including Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Sam Jaffe, and Mort Sahl. John Belushi was to appear in the film, but he died 6 weeks before production began. So basically I'm going to try to get a précis of some kind. Here we go, plot. The plot concerns a young man, Adam, played by Galligan, who dreams of becoming an artist. On returning to his relatives in Manhattan, he finds that the Port Authority has taken control of the city, and he is forced to work in a menial job under a trigger-happy boss, Dan Aykroyd. His kindness to a tramp leads him to be taken into an underground network where he discovers that the city's tramps are controlling the destiny of all the cities in the world. They instruct him to travel to the moon on a mission to spread peace and find his true love. Galligan accidentally finds a bus traveling to the moon, and I won't spoil it any more than that. This is a very weird film. And when I say weird, if you've been a listener for a while, you mean you know, I mean weird in a good way. It's very much phrased. A lot of the film looks like a 1930s Warner Brothers or Universal picture. In fact, the start of it very much plays like that. Adam's a young man who's living in Europe and doesn't quite know what he wants to do. He talks to a Swedish guy on a train and decides that he wants to travel back to America and become an artist. He doesn't know what kind of artist. That's the start. He just has no idea what kind of artist he wants to be. So he travels back to Manhattan and finds that the Port Authority, in an emergency, has taken over the whole city and basically runs it. His aunt and uncle take him in, but he eventually gets a job with the Port Authority, basically policing one of the tunnels into Manhattan with his boss, played by Dan Aykroyd. Now, if this doesn't make any sense, don't worry about it too much. This is one of those films that you really have to go along for the ride with. He's kind to a tramp, and the tramp invites him into the underground where all the tramps who rule the world, cities, live. And the interesting thing is, right up until the point where he goes in where the tramps are, the film's in black and white. It's only when he gets to where the tramps live that it becomes colour. He's initiated in by them. The nature of the world is explained to him. And he's told he has to go to the moon and meet his true love, played by Lauren Tom. He stumbles onto a bus full of old people who... The front of the bus says they're going to Miami, but they're actually not going to Miami. They're going to the moon by bus. Now, I'm just going to play a little bit of Imogen Coca, who's one of the old people on the bus, explaining what, how and why a bus full of retired people is travelling to the moon.
It's all supposed to be top secret, but you look like such a nice young man. I can't see why we can't talk. It all began back in the 50s when the government went up to the moon and established a base up there. Then they chose old folks to fly. Because I guess there aren't too many people who care about you when you get older, you know? Every time we take a trip, the government would send our postcards via Miami. So it looked like we were having just a little vacation, you know? I'm writing this to my grandson. You have to write three. Our families don't even know the difference.
But didn't you ever talk about visiting the moon?
Oh, yes, of course. But the chip they put in prevents us from saying moon.
Chip? What's that?
It's a little electronic thingamajig. They put it in right here, right in the base of your skull. Whenever you try to say the word moon, it changes it to Miami. You should see the expression on our family's faces when we talk about the craters of Miami. They think we're senile, I guess.
This movie was a surprise. I'm not even sure how I heard about it, but I did, and I managed to locate a copy. It is on Rapid Share, and there may even be a torrent or two about if you search under the title of the film, which actually also shares the same title, Nothing Lasts Forever, with the book that the movie Die Hard was based on. Nothing to do with the book. The book by Roderick Thorpe was called Nothing Lasts Forever, but it shares the same title as this film. So basically, I'll tell you why I like the movie. First off, there's not another movie like it. It's weird. It creates its own universe. There's this weird alternate universe, which borrows enormously from 1930s science fiction and 1930s neorealist dramas from Warner Brothers and things like that. It's kind of got an early 1950s TV science fiction show vibe about it. And it's very knowing about old movies and old media in general, in the sense of being antique media rather than like traditional media in the other sense. And it's a lot of fun to watch. It takes a little while for your head to get around the concepts. And once you accept the fact that this is set in its own universe, which doesn't bear a lot of commonality with our own, it is quite fun. I mean, there's fantastic little moments of weirdness in this film, and I'm surprised that it's not better known. It's got cult film written all over it, and the people who've seen it consider it a classic. But I mean, you know, bus full of old people get off on the moon, have to put special sunglasses on, of course, because there's a bit of glare up there, and they're greeted by a whole bunch of moon maidens in grass skirts who do a hula dance for them. So it's just totally off the wall, bugfuck, crazy fun, really. And it does end a little bit abruptly, in the way, quite similar to the way that some 1930s screwball comedies ended abruptly. It very much has that feel to it. But I liked it, and it's a pity that it hasn't had a DVD release. I've done a little bit of research on this, and the reason is that it borrows so much from various old movies and old movie tropes and things. There are some issues with getting the rights to certain parts of it for use in the film. So the people who own the rights just simply aren't able to release it because it has little bits of borrowing that they have to get clearance for. So, Dan Aykroyd's in it. He's a bit of fun. He's not doing anything at a level much deeper than he did on Saturday Night Live in the 70s. Zach Galligan's a kind of naive little Candide character in this weird universe. His uncle's played by Mort Sahl, the satirist from the 1950s. One of the bits, I'll do a minor spoiler, but only to kind of demonstrate how groovy this movie is. Adam, the character, gets on the bus, and it's a bus, right? It's an old-fashioned 1950s-style bus. And he sits on the bus takes off. When it gets into space, everybody gets up, goes upstairs into the dining room to have dinner. They have dinner. Then they go into the nightclub where Eddie Fisher is doing a cabaret in the nightclub inside a bus. It's one of those TARDIS type things. The bus is much bigger on the inside than the outside, but you just kind of go with it because it's no weirder than any of the rest of the film. And so Eddie Fisher, Carrie Fisher's father, Debbie Reynolds' ex-husband, Elizabeth Taylor's ex-husband, is doing a 1950s nightclub act on a bus travelling to the moon. If that's not enough to grab you to see this film, I do not know what is. It's a small film. It had a $3 million budget at the time. It did absolutely no business because it's not one of those films that is easy to categorise in any way. But it's a lot of fun, and people I know, like Danny and Mondi, you guys are going to love this film if you can grab a copy of it. It's got weirdness written all over it. It's somewhere on that line between, say, in the cult weirdness category, between something like Sons of Steel and any of the other cult films from the 1980s that nobody has ever heard of. And it's worth watching. I think we should manage to show it at a science fiction convention at some stage, because the rights aren't clearly available, even though the ownership is. Maybe you can slide it under the radar there. But it's a beautiful, weird little film. It does kind of satirize certain things. It satirizes unions, it satirizes management, it satirizes exploitations of workers, it satirizes the artistic pretensions of people with no talent. And even with all of that, there's a kind of sweetness about the film as well, a sweetness about the characters in it. There's nobody really monstrously nasty. It also has a go at pretentious artists in a couple of scenes, which are quite funny in their own way. It's not like gut laugh funny, but it's amusing and sweet and interesting all the way through the film. Particularly if you're familiar with and into old black and white films from, say, the 1920s to the 1940s. But all I can say is Nothing Lasts Forever. It's worth seeing. If it ever comes out on DVD, it is definitely worth acquiring, because I know pretty much everybody I talk to about this podcast has beautifully weird and fucked up taste in movies, which is why I love all you guys. So I'm going to just take another break now and then talk about the second one of the films, 99 and 44 hundredths% Dead. Mm-hmm.
She was young, she was pure, she was new, she was nice. She was fair, she was sweet, 17. He was old, he was vile and no stranger to vice. He was base, he was bad, he was mean. He had slyly inveigled her up to his flat apartment to view his collection of stamps. And he said, as he hastened to put out the cat, the wine, his cigar, and the lamps, "Have some Madeira, Madeira. You really have nothing to fear. I'm not trying to tempt you, that wouldn't be right. You shouldn't drink spirits at this time of night. Have some Madeira, Madeira. It's very much nicer than beer. I don't care for sherry, one cannot drink stout. And port is a wine I can well do without. It's simply a case of shack an ass on gout. Have some Madeira, Madeira. Unaware of the wiles of the snake in the grass, of the fate of the maiden who topes, she lowered her standards by raising her glass, her courage, her eyes, and his hopes. She sipped it, she drank it, she drained it, she did. He quietly refilled it again. And he said, as he secretly carved one more notch on the butt of his gold-handled cane, "Have some Madeira, Madeira. I've got a small cask of it here. Once it's been opened, you know it won't keep. Finish it up, it will help you to sleep. Have some Madeira, Madeira. It's really an excellent year. Now, if it were gin, you'd be wrong to say yes. The evil gin does would be hard to assess. Besides, it's inclined to affect me finesse. Have some Madeira, Madeira. Then there flashed through her mind what her mother had said, with her antepenultimate breath. "Oh, my child, should you look on the wine when 'tis red, be prepared for a fate worse than death." She let go her glass with a shrill little cry.
Oh.
Crash, tinkle, it fell to the floor. When he asked what in heaven, she made no reply, up her mind in a dash for the door. "Have some Madeira, Madeira," rang out down the hall loud and clear, a tremulous cry that was filled with despair. As she paused to take breath in the cool midnight air, "Have some Madeira, Madeira," the words seemed to ring in her ear. Until the next morning she woke up in bed with a smile on her lips and an ache in her head and a voice in her ear all that tickled and said, "Have some Madeira, Madeira."
That, of course, was Flanders and Swann with "Have Some Madeira, Madeira," a classic of debauchery, which is one of the main themes of Paleo Cinema Podcast at various times. On to the next movie, 99 44 hundredths percent Dead. Now, the title is actually a pastiche on an old Ivory soap commercial where they were talking about Ivory soap being 99 44 hundredths percent pure. That was before Marilyn Chambers, who was on the soap packets at the time, made behind a green door, and the 99 44 hundredths percent pure thing became a punchline. So, moving along, it was directed by John Frankenheimer when he was in his cocaine years. So we'll make some allowances for that in the film. I'll just give you a bit of a précis, and then I'll talk about why it's a film of interest. Harry Crown, a stylish professional hitman with a pair of Browning high-power 9mm pistols with ivory grips, carrying a shoulder holster, is brought in by mob boss Uncle Frank Kelly when his operation is challenged by Big Eddie, a grinning, lisping rival. Uncle Frank's played by Edmund O'Brien in his last acting role, and Big Eddie is played by Bradford Dillman. Crown is caught in the crossfire, as is his romantic interest Buffy, a third grade school teacher played by Anne Turkell, whom Richard Harris, who plays Harry Crown, subsequently married. In his attempt to take over the racket, Spaghetti has hired Marvin the Claw Zuckerman, Chuck Connors, a sadistic one-armed killer with a prosthetic attachment that includes machine guns and knives. Buffy is abducted, causing Harry to ignore Uncle Frank's warning not to take on Eddie's men in broad daylight. Showdown in a warehouse results in the Claw being overpowered and literally disarmed. Harry appears to be too late to save Buffy, but a gunshot rings out, blah, 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 blah. So the cast: Richard Harris, Edmund O'Brien, Bradford Dillman, Anne Turkell, Constance Ford, David Hall playing Tony, who's a kind of minor hitman in Uncle Frank's employ. who Harry Crown takes under his wing. Catherine Bauman plays Baby, Tony's girlfriend. And Chuck Connors as Marvin Claus Zuckerman. This is an interesting film. It's got a fantastic title sequence, which you can find on the Paleo Cinema website. Basically, the title cards are done in a kind of pop art Roy Lichtenstein style with a Henry Mancini score behind it, which is an interesting Henry Mancini score because it sounds a lot more like Lalo Schifrin than it does Henry Mancini. When I heard it again recently, I thought, that's got to be Schifrin. But no, in fact, it was Mancini. And it's followed by a panning montage. A guy gets chucked in the off a pier with concrete overshoes and falls into the water, of course, and then there's a panning shot underwater showing exactly what is already under the water. And there's a narration just setting up the movie done by Richard Harris. I'll play that for you now and then go into it. So just imagine this camera panning over broken down slot machines and safes and roulette tables and a whole bunch of different people with concrete shoes on floating underwater.
When a thing's got no more use, everybody knows where to toss it. Losers. All of them losers here on the east side. They sprawl on the bottom, just a lot of spongy junk. Puffing up and rusting out. Things get old around here, quick. The little fishies nibble on the soft parts. Levants, busted slots, Frenchy roulette wheels, chemi shoes, rot gut and safes full of nothing. Here on the bottom, all the good old friends get together, rot, pollute, and stick around. Yes, the east side's got the great old bunch. Now, around here, there's a whole different clientele. Slummy. Puerto Rican rum runners, wops in spaghetti suits, Greek bookies, Polish union bosses, cut-rate Shylocks. They lounge around here tied to any old thing. Not even worth fresh cement, strung together like a daisy chain. Déclassé. This was the beginning of the third day of the war. It was a bad time. A lot of people got caught up in it, and every one of them figured things only went one way. It was going to get worse.
So that's basically the setup for the film. The only copy I could get of this was a VHS transcription, which is not the best. I'd love to get this on DVD. So if anybody hears of it coming out on DVD, please do let me know. It's also available in its entirety on YouTube, so you can get it that way if you don't have another way to source the material. One of the things you will notice in this film is that Richard Harris looks fucking weird. Now, I've always liked Richard Harris. I think he was the fantastic in Camelot playing King Arthur. I think he was great in any number of the things he did. There was never anything Richard Harris did that was really dull. But he looks fucking weird in this. He's got this kind of page boy haircut. Most of it's a comb over, of course, because the guy's hair was, the tide in his hair was going out. But he's got this weird page boy mullety, curly looking hairstyle. And what can only be described as aviator spectacles rather than aviator shades. And it's a look that's kind of dated really weirdly. Not just badly, but weirdly. And I find that amusing in itself, and it kind of puts you into a different headspace when you're watching the film. It's also very much a pop art, op art kind of film, which in itself is a bit strange because the whole pop art, op art thing reached its peak around 65, 66, 67, and 68. And this film was made in 74, so it was, even when it was being made, it was out of its time in a sense. It really was already slightly dated. Everybody else was moving on to blaxploitation, boogie-oogie-oogie kind of stylings. And this film seems to have its, stylistically at least, stuck in the 1960s Roy Lichtenstein pop art era, which makes it an unusual project. But it's got interesting actors. As I said, it's Edmund O'Brien's last role. He won a Best Supporting Actor, I think, in The Barefoot Contessa in the mid-1950s, and not too many years after this film was made, died through complications from Alzheimer's. So he may have been having difficulties already at the time the film was made. But nonetheless, he kind of does his usual over-the-top acting bit as Uncle Frank. He really brings to the game. Richard Harris is kind of stoic and underplayed in this film. Anne Turkel, the best thing to be said for her is she's very attractive. Chuck Connors playing a slightly different role for him, but not entirely dissimilar to the role he played in Soylent Green around the same time, where he played a kind of hitman, in essence a hitman type character in that film as well. But in this one he's got the little conceit of having a prosthetic hand, which he replaces with a knife, a gun, a feather duster, a wine bottle opener, and a few other cute things like that. It seemed to be a time for unusual prostheses around then. I mean, it's in this film, it's in Enter the Dragon, with the main villain in Enter the Dragon. There are any number of movies where, at the time, where people with artificial hands tended to put other things onto them to utilize, in a sense. But he's not really great. And Chuck Connors was never a good actor. He was a striking actor. And I remember him mostly from his TV series Thrill Seekers. Now, there was that rumor about Chuck Connors back in the 50s that he did a gay porn film. But I've seen the footage and it doesn't look terribly like him. So I'm a bit doubtful about that. But anyway, the thing is that, like the first film I mentioned, Nothing Lasts Forever, this film creates its own world. It's a kind of gangster world in the same sense that A Crimson Pirate is set in a pirate world, which, of course, Burt Lancaster says in A Crimson Pirate. This is in a gangster world. You only ever see cops once in cop cars, and they never seem to be interacting at all with the crimes that are going on. I mean, there are shootings, there are vast shootouts, there's bootleg liquor. There's all these sort of tropes from the past of gangster films which come into play in this movie, but the cops never seem to be part of it. It's an anarchic, strange, kind of almost dystopian world that's set up in this film. Now, I'm not taking it too seriously because I realise that Frankenheimer did it as a satire on gangster films, but I think maybe a better writer would have been called for to kind of sharpen and emphasize the satire. It's not a great film. I mean, I'm not trying to convince you that it's the best thing since Scarface, the original Scarface, not the one with Pacino. But it is a kind of interesting effort, and it shows the kind of movies that were being made in the 1970s by studios. It was a studio film rather than an indie. It didn't come out of one of Corman's production companies or anything like that. But it does have the virtues of Frankenheimer's work. He does some great set-piece action scenes in it. He has some unusual locations, including a giant inflatable structure where Harry Crown meets Buffy when she's got a whole bunch of school kids on a school trip. And a number of other locations, including a brothel in a high-rise building. But thanks for reminding me of this film, Rupert. I'm not sure I'm going to visit it again too much in the future. I think I've got a lot of other things to keep me amused, but I kind of enjoyed it. Over the top, fantastically enjoyed, but it's amusing. It's a little bit of fun. But it does set up this wonderfully unique world about it, which is probably its main virtue. The fact that when you're in the film, you're in somewhere else. You're in a kind of conceptual headspace of a gangster world where gangsters are the kings and there are two kings fighting over a territory in a modern thing. And yeah, there are times when the film goes into schmaltzy romance and other times when it goes into slapstick, almost like Warner Brothers cartoon comedy. And all the actors really know this. Bradford Dillman camps it up tremendously as the other crime head in the film. You see people like Burt Young in the film, and everybody, with the possible exception of Richard Harris's character, seems to know that it's a piss take of a film. And yeah, I think the thing that lets this film down most, and I think the actors are great. I think Frankenheimer, even if he did have a snowed nose, is great. I think the script really needed more work than it gave it. It really needed to kind of tighten up and, in a sense, give a cohesion to it that the film doesn't quite have. That when it goes from one type of comedy to another and one type of satire to another, there's not a natural flow to that. It all seems a little bit arbitrary to me. But it's worth checking out, and you can check it out on YouTube, so it's not going to cost you anything more than download. So that's pretty much it for that film. It's a bit of a cult film, but I found it less interesting than the other two films I talk about in this podcast. So I'm sorry if I disappoint you there, Rue, but I think there's a film worth watching because it's one of Frankenheimer's, and Frankenheimer's career is always an interesting thing to look through, but maybe not one of my favourites. So I'm just going to take another break now, and I'll just play a little more of Uncle Frank talking from the film. I'll take a little bit of a break, and then I'll come back to talk about Night of the Eagle from 1962, starring Peter Wingard.
Who trusts him, Uncle Frank?
Big Eddie. Maybe you heard. It's been going on for a week. It's a war, Harry, between Big Eddie and me. He's got the waterfront locked. He's been putting his feet on me. He wants the city. My city, Harry. He's been sewing my boys down.
What is it you mean, Uncle Frank?
You I want here. You're the best, Harry. I've known that always. There's nobody better.
How much?
$10,000.
$80,000.
Make it 100.
Night of the Eagle is a 1962 British horror film. In America, it was known as Burn, Witch, Burn. But the original title is Night of the Eagle. It was directed by Sidney Hayes, a director who went on to do a lot of English television subsequent to this, and produced by Albert Fennell, who went on to produce a whole bunch of different TV shows for ITV. The scriptwriters are interesting. It's Charles Beaumont, who did a whole bunch of different things in the 70s. He did a lot of Twilight Zone episodes. He wrote the script for The Seven Faces of Dr. Lowe, amongst other things, and a bunch of other things. And also Richard Matheson, who did Legend of Hell House. He did the voodoo doll part of that Karen Black TV movie in the 1970s, which was called, he said, remembering, Trilogy of Terror. And it was all based on a 1943 novel by Fritz Lieber, a well-known science fiction and fantasy author who was working well into the 1980s and 1990s before his death, called Conjure Wife. The film starred Janet Blair, an American actress, Peter Wingard, Margaret Johnston, and Anthony Nichols. So the film's a lovely little horror thriller kind of thing. It only runs 90 minutes, but it does a very good job of it. I first saw it years ago on TV and remembered it, and then later on I got a chance to see it at the ACME, the Australian Centre for the Moving Image, here in Melbourne. They were doing a horror season, and they had it on the big screen, and yeah, it's a bloody effective little thriller in the kind of style that the English do very well, or did very well in those days. I'll give you a synopsis. Norman Taylor, played by Peter Wingard, a psychology professor lecturing in belief and superstition, discovers that his wife Tansy, Janet Blair, is a practicing witch. She's insistent that her charms have been responsible for his academic success. Angry at her superstition, he forces her to burn them all. But almost immediately, things start to go wrong with him as a pupil accuses him of sexual harassment, and he's drawn into his wife's web of superstitions, forcing him to believe in order to survive as a rival witch tries to use black magic to destroy both him and his wife. So that's basically the setup of it, and it's very well done. In the sense, it's a little bit like Night of the Demon. As you remember, in Night of the Demon, the main character is a psychology professor who doesn't believe in witchcraft and superstition, played by Daniel Andrews, but who, through events, comes to believe and in order to survive. So it's a bit, these movies are a bit about encompassing a wider universe in order to survive. They're about adaptability. They're about people stepping out of their comfort zone and realizing that things aren't as they suspect they are. So I'll just play a clip of Norman lecturing his students, just to give you a setup of it, and then I'll talk a little bit further about why I find this film really, really interesting.
I do not believe. I do not believe. So, to recap, four words necessary to destroy the forces of the supernatural, witchcraft, superstition, the psychic, etc., etc. And these, quote, are a morbid desire to escape from reality, unquote, and can only exist in an atmosphere of belief. Belief is vital. Deprived of that acceptance, it reveals itself as another futile attempt to control one's environment and the forces of nature. Each day, science...
Do you include domestic superstitions like walking under ladders or the third match or people who wear good luck charms?
Well, they're all based on primitive beliefs. While actually denying any belief, people guard themselves by saying there may be something in it, and so they wear protections. I think it depends on how personal the belief is. A friend of mine in the Air Force used to carry a lock of his wife's hair under his flying helmet for good luck.
Did it work?
No, he was killed. So, each day, science, founded on years of research and truth, emerges with feats which put our old-fashioned magicians to shame. Aladdin rubbed a lamp, and a genie appeared. Today, we can press a button, and the whole of mankind is obliterated.
I love this film for a number of reasons, but one of them is Peter Wingard. When I was a young and impressionable boy, there was a TV series called Department S and then Jason King, where Peter Wingard played Jason King, who was a writer and an adventurer, very stylish, with a Fu Manchu mustache and any number of girls around him. He was pretty much a fop, but he dressed very well. He was very stylish. And in those early years, one of the things that I didn't understand was that he was very campy. And indeed, Peter Wingard was and is a gay gentleman. Now, he nearly didn't get the job of playing Norman in this film because he was considered to be a bit too fey to portray someone who's very much in love with his wife. But Wingard is a fine actor, much underrated. He's done a lot of stage work as well. And in this film, he does portray somebody very much in love with his wife very, very well. And in fact, this is pretty much his only starring role in a movie. And I think he does it very well. I do like him in this role. I mean, he's passionate about the fact that he loves his wife, the fact that he's a rationalist, the fact that his whole career, as a kind of precursor to people like Richard Dawkins, is about overwhelming superstition, getting rid of superstition as a force in human lives. And he's very persuasive of that. And at the time, he was a great-looking guy. Now, I'll give you a little bit of gossip about Peter Wingard. For 10 years, from 1956 to 1966, he was in a relationship with Alan Bates, the actor. Now, Alan Bates, being bisexual, subsequently went on to live and love, and in fact, father children with a woman, with a couple of different women, in fact. But during his early career, he was very much known to be part of a homosexual couple. So Peter Wingard, who around London acting circles was known as Petunia Winegum because of his homosexuality, really didn't get the career that he deserved because of his sexuality, in a sense. And I think very much that this film shows that Wingard was, when the opportunity arose, quite a fine actor. There's some scenes in this film where he's being chased by supernatural entities. I won't do too much of a spoiler, though. The spoiler tends to be in the title of the film, where he is vividly terrified by what's going on, and his acting very much reflects that. It's he is a very fine actor, and underappreciated for that. And he also portrays somebody who is very much in love with his wife, very, very effectively. And the arc of the character from being a strict rationalist to based on the evidence that appears before him and the things that occur in his life, moving on to somebody who can encompass the fact that there's some kind of cause and effect nature to this witchcraft that's going on, really is portrayed well. There's a smooth seamlessness to it that I love these films where you get a small film, nothing big. It's kind of a B picture in a sense, but the acting, if carefully watched, lifts it above what's strictly necessary for that kind of thing. And maybe it was supposed to be a showcase role for Wingard to prove that he can play straight. But that subtext of the man's sexuality is unfortunately part of the arc of this man's particular career. And I'm just trying to look through his resume on IMDb, and I really can't see any other roles where he played the main character in a film, which is somewhat unfortunate. But the other cast members are very, very good. Let me see. Jenna Blair, who started her career in the US, of course, is very good as Tansy, his wife. She there's an interesting kind of feminist perspective you can take on this, that the women know how the world really works. And because of the way society is set up, their survival mechanism and their way of dealing with things is to support their husbands and their husband's career and aspirations, because, of course, society at the time wasn't particularly supportive of women in careers. So there's a kind of feminist subtext you can take from this, that the women are very much the ones with the real power in this kind of setup. Now, Margaret Johnston, who plays the I'll be honest, she plays the villain in the film, is an actress whose face you'd recognise, but there hasn't been any role that really stands out. But she is very, very good. She's also in another film that I'd love to get a copy of. It's an English film directed by Freddie Francis in 1966 called The Psychopath, starring Patrick Wymark, John Standing, and Margaret Johnson. Alexander Knox is in it as well. And I saw this one when I was a kid, and I'd love to get a copy of it because it's a really eerie thriller. Problem is that there's a lot of movies called The Psychopath out there, and it's difficult sometimes to differentiate between them. But there are some other fine actors in the film as well. Anthony Nichols, who went on to play Tremaine in the TV series The Champions, is in there. Kathleen Byron, who was in Black Narcissus playing the nun who goes nuts, is effective in there. I would have liked to have seen more of her in the film, but the story didn't really permit that. Reginald Beckwith is in there. Norman Bird. Just a good, solid acting ensemble of English character actors in the film. Now, I'm going to play another clip from it where Norman confronts Tansy about her witchcraft, and then I'll wrap it up.
Well, what, darling? I have to put these away.
In a moment.
I want to get lunch, Norman.
In a moment.
Looks a grin.
What's the meaning of all this?
I simply must put these away, Norman. All right, what do you want?
The truth.
I told you, they're souvenirs.
The truth.
All right. I was trying to use conjure magic, trying to work spells, trying to change the future. That's what you really want to hear, isn't it, Norman?
That's exactly what I don't want to hear.
Then believe what I told you last night.
About one dried-up spider, yes, but not all that rubbish. Graveyard dirt.
What do you want to believe?
I want some kind of explanation.
But is it obvious? I'm a witch.
I'm not finding this very amusing.
Norman, I only have so many answers. Take your choice.
What do you mean? Are you trying to tell me that you've been attempting witchcraft? I can't believe it. Why? How did you ever begin?
Does it matter, Norman?
Yes. And knowing what you do about its background?
Well, when you say it like that, of course it sounds ridiculous.
Ridiculous? It's stupid.
But, Norman, when you want things to happen or not to happen to someone you love... Oh, Norman, the things I did, they seem to work.
What things?
At least most of the time.
Don't you see the very exceptions prove the things you were doing didn't work?
There were other evil forces working against
us. I can't believe it. A woman of your intelligence. Is this the way you've been spending your time at the cottage? And I thought that you were... I'm sorry. You must have been very bored. Darling. Now look at all that. You can't be serious about it.
From the moment we arrived here, we've been faced with such hostility from the
hostility?
Fact... Yes! Their hatred and their petty jealousy. I was afraid they would destroy us.
You're imagining these things. What's got into you? Is this some kind of a joke?
Norman, I feel very strongly about this.
But when did this all start, and why?
2 years ago in Jamaica. When you almost died in that terrible accident.
One of the things that makes, well, some of the things that make this film really work are the fact that it's in a domestic environment. You know, he's an academic. She looks after the household, as things were in those days. And the magic that is created in the film is created through very ordinary things. A tape recorder, for instance, is one of the main means by which a spell is cast. Little dolls attached to lampshades. Kind of domestic things. It is kind of hedge magic in a sense. It's really integrated into the daily lives of the people who practice this kind of witchcraft. So it kind of brings it on from medieval witchcraft, which used, of course, things that were in the technologies of medieval days to modern ones. And that's kind of an interesting thing in this film, that use of contemporary things to conjure magic with. And also, the film's in a sense about a man losing power in his own household. You know, the fact that women, in some ways, in the world that this film creates, and again, this is at the, like with the other two films I'm talking about, this film creates its own world, its own environment, its own universe, in a sense. One of the things is that the man is losing the power in this universe. Women are more powerful, though their power is unspoken and behind the scenes. So I'll leave that to other people to make the parallels there, but it really is an interesting aspect of it. And there are strong female characters in this film, even though Peter Wingard, of course, is the focus of it. His love of his wife is the motivating engine behind the action in the film, and her love of him. So that mutuality is portrayed very well. There's a very good rapport between the two actors playing in this film with both Peter Wingard and Janet Blair. They do have a great rapport, and they're believable as a couple, which is the main thing that holds this film together. There's some special effects stuff, but it's not really large scale. There's a lot of implied horror and an implied attack by a monster, which is done very well. It's very understated, and I think that I've said this before, a lot of modern horror movies could learn a lot from the subtlety and the oblique approach that a film like this uses. It's the audiences are somewhat different now, but I think that kind of suspense and mounting tension is really something that it'd be great to get back to in a number of films. Some films do it, and some films do it very well. But without this kind of film as a guide, I think that we'd have lost something somewhere along the line. That subtlety is a very powerful force in conveying emotion in movies. That kind of ratcheting up of tension, that going from Norman, the academic with the loving wife, to Norman, the man whose fingers are trembling as he tries to conjure magic to stop his wife from dying. It's a great little film, and it's in beautiful black and white, widescreen, and any print I've seen of it is great. Of the three movies I talk about this time, this one's got the best available prints. It may well be out on DVD. I've acquired it by other means, but it looks like a DVD transcription, so you should be able to find this film fairly easily. And it is a lovely little... It'd make a great double feature with Night of the Demon. They're thematically similar, and they do things very well. Now, the director of this film, Sidney Hayes, also did another film that I would love at some stage to talk about in Paleo Cinema. It's I could actually talk about two films made roughly the same time in Paleo Cinema. I'm just going to get the name of it so I get the name exactly right. Circus of Horrors. There's also another movie called Circus of Terror from around the same time. Circus of Horror stars Anton Differing and Donald Pleasence, among other things, so I really should talk about those films. Again, it's directed by Sidney Hayes, and the guy was good at this kind of early 1960s horror. He didn't work for Hammer or any of those ones, but he's very much ploughing the same field as the Hammer films were at the time, and I really think that he does a really sterling job on this film. The movie's been remade a couple of times. Well, the story has been remade a couple of times. It was made Weird Woman, starring Lon Chaney Jr., and a movie called Witches Brew, starring Terry Garr, Richard Benjamin, and Lana Turner, were both based on the same novel. But I think of the three, this is probably the best adaptation. It's a reality-based horror thing. It's really a supernatural thing, and it does a lovely little job. So that's about it for the films this time around. I'm going to take another break because apparently I seem to be getting a slightly sore throat for some reason, and I'll be back with
the feedback.
Okay, first off, we've got some feedback from Vince over at the B Movie Cast. Thanks, Vince. I owe you guys a voicemail, and I will get around to it. Next weekend, I'm doing all my voicemails to you guys, GTTMC, and any other podcasts that I really owe feedback and who have supported me enormously. And to be honest, Vince, you were the first podcaster that supported this podcast, and thank you very much for that, mate. But I'll play your feedback from your new Android phone, which sounds very good, by the way, and we'll get going.
Hey, Jerry, this is Vince from South Carolina. I just said I'd give you a quick call. I'm in the car on my way home from the nuke plant, and I was just calling you on my new Android phone. This thing's pretty cool. Anyway, been enjoying the podcast a whole lot, and I know you talked about the 10th Victim, and you made me want to watch that. I've had that in my collection for a long time, so I'm going to have to dig it out and watch it. I like that type of old Italian Euro spy or whatever you want to call it. I also really like the music from that era, too. But anyway, like I said, been enjoying the podcast. The sound quality you ask about, it broke up a few times, but it wasn't too bad. I know sometimes it's hard to get all that equipment, you know, working just the way you want it. But that's no big deal. And just real quick, there's a couple movies I wanted to know your thoughts on if you've seen them. One's Reflection in the Golden Eye, I think it's called, with Marlon Brando, Elizabeth Taylor. It was kind of a strange one for me, so I'd like your comments on that if you've seen it. And the second one is Lady in the Cage with Olivia de Havilland. So I guess that's about it now. I guess I shouldn't be talking when I'm on the phone anyway, you know, living dangerously, but that's about it, man. Take it easy, dude. Keep the podcast coming.
Thanks, Vince. This is the first voicemail I've ever received from somebody returning home from a nuclear power plant. So, the two movies you mentioned, Reflections in the Golden Eye, I think it was based on a novel by Carson McCullers. It's got Elizabeth Taylor and Marlon Brando in it, and there's a lot of sexual tension and some weird shit. I think Brian Keith's in it, and he plays a character who's got a wife who cut off her own nipples when she was in postnatal depression. It's a campy, weird film, and I think it's from that period of time when Marlon Brando really was pissed off with Hollywood. He'd been playing their games for the best part, well over a decade, really. And he really wanted to take on some roles that he enjoyed and that took him out of the mainstream. And I think this is very much one of those roles. It's an interesting film, but I think it takes itself too seriously, of course. But it'd be a good film to get together with a bunch of knowing friends and a few beers and just have a little bit of fun watching it. It hasn't aged well, but it's silly. Silly's my new word for films that take themselves way too seriously. But yeah, that one I haven't seen Lady in the Cage yet. Since you did it on your podcast, and I recommend that people download that episode, because you and I think Nick at the time did a great job on dissecting Lady in a Cage. When I can get a hold of a copy, I will, and I'll let you guys know through my podcast what I thought of it. While we're on that subject too, I still haven't watched Unman Wittering and Zygo. I did promise that I would do that, I think, for Richard in Wichita. Haven't got around to it yet. Worldcon just fucked my brain. The World Science Fiction Convention just blew me totally away. I've spent a whole week watching the entire second, third, and fourth seasons of Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job, just to mess my head around. And I recommend that show if you can find it, partly because there are a whole episode which is ostensibly directed by Tommy Wiseau, who directed The Room, and Tommy Wiseau is in the episode. So these guys are definitely film buffs of the right kind. And of course it's got John C. Reilly in it, and he's always a lot of fun. But yeah, I haven't had a chance to watch much film apart from going through episodes of Tim and Eric. So there you go, next time around. I've promised myself, after I finish the podcast and get it uploaded, I'm going to watch my copy of Enter the Dragon on Blu-ray, which I haven't watched yet, and a couple of other films, including the second one of the OSS Sondicept movies with Jean Dujardin in it, OSS Sondicept Lost in Rio. I've got a copy of that on DVD, and I am going to enjoy it just as much as I enjoyed the first one. So on to the next one of the voicemails.
His name was Rico. He wore a diamond with yellow feathers in her hair. He saw Sammy dancing there, and when he finished, he called him over. But Willie went a bit too far. Sammy sailed across the bar, and then the punches flew, and they were smashed in two. There was blood in a single gunshot, but just who shot who? Terry Frost, welcome to Zomania. And you know something? This is what I sound like when I have a toothache. Oh, anyway, this is the Dr. Zom. And I was just calling to have a chat with my main man from down under, Terry, the T-Man, Frost. And I just wanted to call and say hello. Basically, been kind of just chilling and riding and chilling. Watching the Red Riding Trilogy. I've got two of those knocked off already. I got one more to go. Very, very good flicks. Just read, for some reason, that Hollywood has decided that they want to remake the Red Riding Trilogy, and they're trying to get, or have gotten, Ridley Scott. My dog just cut the stinkiest fart I have ever smelled in my life, and it makes my toothache just feel so much better. I love to smell the aroma of the canine
while he licks his balls, while I'm talking to Paleo Cinema. Anyway, so there. Okay, you got a pair of friends. Yeah. Red Riding Trilogy. I don't know why they're deciding to remake it, but it's pretty damn good. So, I mean, if they could... I don't know if they'd be able to top what's on, what's out already, but you know what I'm saying. You know what I'm saying. Anyway, looking right now at The Red Tent with Sean Connery and Peter Finch, Hardy Krueger, Mario Adorf, Russian-made movie. Not a great movie, but I'll tell you what. I watched it the other day. Haven't watched it in a long time. Dusted off the old VHS, threw it in. And you know what? It's a pretty good. It holds up, I think. You still have the kind of mystical stuff with Finch, the survivor, talking to, you know, the ghosts of the dead people. But the actual story that's built around is a pretty good, story of my train of thought is being smoldered and smothered by this stinky ass dog. But anyway, the other thing that I wanted to bring up while I got you on the phone, Mr. Frost, is two movies that are my two of my favorite Sean Connery movies, since I'm talking about The Red Tent. One is called The Offense, and the other is called The Hill. I don't know if you've seen either one of them. If you have, I'd like to hear some comments, what you think of them. And if you haven't seen them, give them a peek, Daddy-O, because they're pretty good. Right now, I'm going to go in here. I'm going to grab a pair of pliers. I'm going to put some nipple clamps on. I'm going to pull this tooth out. And when I'm done pulling it out, and I'm swallowing all that delicious blood, I'm going to put that tooth in a little package and send it all the way to Australia. So anyway, look forward to finding Zom's tooth. And when you do get it, cherish it, because it's what I eat with every goddamn day. Zom out.
Thank you, Zom. You brought up any number of issues with that particular voicemail. I'm sorry that you having a toothache makes your dog fart and it makes you channel Barry Manilow. But thank you for the voicemail. Sean Connery. Yeah, love Connery stuff. Yes, The Hill. I saw it years ago. I've got to rewatch it. I haven't rewatched it for a couple of decades. I did watch The Offense about two or three years ago. And yeah, great English cop drama with Connery playing a cop basically on the edge of a breakdown and doing it fantastically well. It's a gritty, ugly film. It's maybe you can compare it to something like Get Carter or something along those lines, but a very fine English cop drama. I will rewatch The Hill. It does turn up occasionally on TV here. And now that I have a PVR kind of thing called an IQ box, I can record it and enjoy it, and I will do so. I've got another one to recommend for you if you're on a Connery binge. A Fine Madness, a comedy he did with Gene Seberg in about 1966. He cut a deal for the Bond films, and he wanted to be able to pick his projects if they wanted him to continue with the Bond films. And A Fine Madness, where he pays a New York poet called Samson Shillitoe. And it's a bit of a quirky comedy thing. It's not fantastic, but it's nice seeing Connery do something light and silly. He did a number of other comedies, of course. Wrong is Right comes to mind from 1982. But A Fine Madness is definitely one to check out if you can. Also, Wrong is Right, which is about terrorism and geopolitics and things like that. And quite an interesting film in its own right. Now, Zom, I look forward to the tooth, mate. I may make it into a necklace. I'll put it on my hairy chest and wear shirts that show it off in its wonderfulness. If it arrives, I may try to get somebody to clone you using the DNA in it, but that depends on the budget. Yes, thank you. Please keep the voicemails coming in. In amongst your silly wonderfulness, there's always some good movie stuff in there, and I always do appreciate it, and I love talking to you on Facebook, of course, and I'm glad I was able to help you find something you were looking for there. So, on to the next voicemail.
Hey, Terry, it's Rupert. Just calling, listening to the new episodes, just calling to say I love the French dog breakfast. That's to describe Dayton. I like that phrase a lot. Anyway, so I'm trying 3D this weekend and had a good time with it. Pretty graphic. Violence and nudity, but still quite a bit of fun, and Dreyfuss and Chris Lloyd both have fun cameos. So anyway, I'm curious if you're interested in seeing that. I thought it was fun. But also, I watched something with my wife, and now I'm totally blanking on what it is, that I thought might be of interest to you. I remember. I did the interview with the Severn Films guys, and I was curious what you thought of it, if you get a chance to listen to it whenever you do. But what came up during that interview was a lot of different movies, including a really interesting eating disorder movie called A Secret Between Friends, which I'm currently trying to track down. But also Trent Harris came up, and both his films, Reuben and Ed and the Beaver Trilogy, came up, which were films I was a fan of prior to the interview, especially Reuben and Ed. And I was wondering if you're a Reuben and Ed fan. And have you seen the Beaver Trilogy? Because it's a very interesting triptych of a film. Very odd. But anyway, that's what I was thinking about. So I will shut up now.
Thanks, Rupert. Yeah, I did hear your interview with the Severn Film guys over at Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema. Yeah, nice job. You guys seem to be riffing off each other pretty well. They sound like a nice bunch of dudes. I'm going to have to track down some of their films. Some of these things can be a little more difficult to locate here in Australia through legitimate means, but I'll see what I can do. As far as Reuben and Ed and the Beaver Trilogy are concerned, I have tracked down copies of them, and I haven't watched them yet because life interrupts me watching movies occasionally. The need to earn money to buy movies stops me from watching movies. It's a vicious and ugly cycle, but I'm going to have to try to come to some accommodation with it. But I've got them on my list. Anything that people recommend me that I can pick up a copy of, I will give a go to. I even gave Antichrist a go as Zomnos. I'm going to come back on that one later when I'm in a more sanguine state of mind. But please keep the recommendations coming through, guys. I always love it, and I always look forward to getting voicemails so that I can get more of them. And if you can't do voicemails, send emails to cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U, @gmail.com. You can contact me on paleocinema, lowercase no dash, on Twitter, or Terry Frost, lowercase no space, on Twitter. I've got two Twitter accounts. You can go to the website or the cultguru at gmail.com. And also you can leave voicemails. I'm on Skype as Paleo Cinema. Now, having mentioned Skype, what I should mention is I am going to start using Skype as part of the podcast in the future. I did talk to Irk about it, and a couple of other podcasters around who do different podcasts in Australia while I was at Worldcon. And it's definitely something I want to do. I've already got one person I want to be a guest. I've got two or three others I want to ask to be guests. So that's one thing I want to look forward to doing in the next 6 months or so. And one of the other things I want to do is I talked to Irk about his podcasting rig. He's got a mobile podcasting rig. And the Belkin Go studio that I've got, I've figured out finally how to make it optimally function as a portable podcasting studio with two microphones attached and all the bells and whistles that I would need to make it effective as a podcasting rig. So I'm definitely going to be doing that and taking the thing around and doing some getting some people in so that I don't have to talk to my laptop all the time. So I find that quite exciting. I think it's going to be a great experiment. I am setting up Skype recording on there, and I'm going to test it out with a few people sometime soon. But I've said that before, but Worldcon, as I said, has messed my head up a little bit in a totally good and wonderful way. So there is that. Now, Let me see. That's all the feedback I really got. I have had some people chatting with me on the Twitter and the Facebook and that sort of thing. So thank you for that. I love that ongoing dialogue we have between each other through a number of different means, including Twitter, of course. And I want to continue that and kind of enhance that stuff in the future. So that's about it this time around. We've run 1.5 hours this time again. So the podcast do seem to be getting longer. Let me know if it's too much for you guys, but I'm enjoying the length at the moment. I'm finding a lot more fun in it. So I'll be back in 3 weeks' time. I think I know what one of the movies I'm going to talk about is. Now, I have promised other movies in the past, and I will get around to them. They're on my list of in my Watchmen notebook to get done, but it's just a matter of A, being in the mood, and B, finding copies of some of these films. So I will get around to it. I will have all of that stuff sorted out. But anyway, enjoy your movie watching over the next 3 weeks until I'm back again. That's about it. Take care of yourselves. Enjoy your movie viewing. And I will be back. Bye-bye.